Genesis chapter 41, part 43 of our lessons in Genesis. Let me turn my Bible so I'm at least in the right vicinity here. We're not going to get all the way through chapter 41. It is one of the lengthier chapters in the book of Genesis, but that's all right. If you remember leading up to this chapter, the butler and the baker, but not the candlestick maker, had dreams and told them to Joseph while they were in jail. Joseph had been able to interpret those dreams, and that instance being an instance parallel to the gospel. And so we had seen that, and hopefully you remember that lesson and are able to benefit from it. This evening, we're not going to find anything quite so deep as we found as that Joseph experienced in jail. But here we do, in fact, find Pharaoh having a dream, and it's going to be to the benefit of Joseph. We'll start the chapter in verse 1. And it came to pass at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh dreamed. And behold, he stood by the river, and behold, there came up out of the river 7 well-favored kine, and fat-fleshed, and they fed in a meadow. Now, the word kine, K-I-N-E, don't let that throw you. That's just Old English for cow. And you can look that up in your Old English dictionary, and you'll find out that that's exactly what that means. It's bovine, the same kind of cows if you go to McDonald's, that's what you had for dinner. And behold, 7 other kine came up after them out of the river, ill-flavored and lean-fleshed, and stood by the other kine upon the brink of the river. And the ill-flavored and lean-fleshed kine did eat up the 7 well-favored and fat kine, and Pharaoh awoke. So the dream woke him right up. And so after waking up in bed, whenever I wake up from a dream, I find myself I'm all sweaty, and I have to flip the pillow over. So after Pharaoh flips his pillow over, he goes back to sleep and dreams again. And that's often what happens to me. Once I have one dream, it's in for a long night of dreaming, although I don't dream very often. But here, Pharaoh dreams again, and starting in verse 5, and he slept and dreamed the second time. And behold, 7 ears of corn came up upon the stalk, rank and good. And behold, 7 thin ears, and blasted upon the east wind, sprung up after them. And the 7 thin ears devoured the 7 rank and full ears. And Pharaoh awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Now, both these dreams obviously troubled Pharaoh. One of the interesting things about the dreams, Mike, if you were to have these dreams, what would strike you about that? You have emaciated cows, and they eat up the fat and full cows, and they're still emaciated. The thin ears of corn eat up the big fat lush ears of corn, and they're still thin. What's strange about that? Well, the fact that they're still thin after they eat, that you expect something to, after it eats, even if it starts out thin, if it eats something that's fat and lush, that it would gain weight, that after it eats it would be fat also. But that wasn't the case. The emaciated, skinny, scrawny cows come up, and they eat up the big old fat, luscious cows, and they're still skinny and scrawny. the little tiny scrawny ears of corn come up, they eat up the big old lush, you know, wonderful, those silver queen, you know, ears of corn. They're nice and sweet and beautiful in midsummer. And the ones that you like put butter and salt on, and you know, and they eat those silver queen corn ears. And after they get done, there's still that nasty field corn, the kind that's, you know, just barely good for eating at all. And you know, that's the unusual part of the dream. No weight's put on from eating, and so that's famine is what it is. Betty, exactly right. So there's no weight. So that's one of the shocking things of the dream, and nobody's fattened by what they're eating. And of course, the true dreams are very similar, and both are very troubling. And so Pharaoh wants interpretation of his dream, and no one could give any interpretation, which, of course, that's not unusual. It came to pass, verse 18, in the morning, verse 8, rather, it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all the wise men thereof, and Pharaoh told them his dream, but there was none that could interpret them unto Pharaoh. Well, if you remember, what had Joseph told the butler and the baker in jail there? How was he able to interpret dreams? Because dreams were of God. Well, the magicians and the wise men of Pharaoh, they were not godly men. They were trying to interpret them with their own wisdom. These dreams, by the way, are revelations from God, and we need to understand that. These weren't just nightmares because he had eaten too much pizza the night before or seen a horror movie or something of that nature. These were actually revelations from God, and the things of God need to be interpreted by the Spirit of God. If you remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, starting in verse 10 through 14, Paul tells us, these are very familiar verses, I'm sure, to all of you, and God hath revealed the things of God unto us by his Spirit, for the Spirit searcheth all things, yea, the deep things of God. For what man knoweth the things of man, save the spirit of man which is in him? So the things of man are known by the spirit of man. But Paul says, even so the things of God knoweth no man but the spirit of God. So when Joseph had interpreted the dreams of the butler and the baker, the reason he knew the outcome of the dreams, he was able to interpret those, is because those dreams were given by God. So we can know that for a reason. There's a reason we can know that, rather, because he was able to interpret them by means of God, by using the Spirit of God. And if they had just been the result of watching a horror movie or something else, there would have been no there would have been no rhyme or reason to the outcome. In other words, he could have given interpretation, but the interpretation would not have come true. But because he gave interpretation, one was going to be restored to his original position, the other was going to lose his head, and those things did come true. And Paul says, even so the things of God knoweth no man but the Spirit of God. Well, the Spirit of God revealed those things unto Joseph. Paul says in verse 12, now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit which is of God. That's how Joseph, in fact, knew what the dreams meant, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God, which things also we speak. So that's what Joseph did. He spoke that which God had given to him, not the words which man's wisdom teacheth, but which the Holy Ghost teacheth, comparing spiritual with spiritual. But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God. So that's why the magicians and the wise men of Egypt couldn't understand the dreams of Pharaoh. because they're foolishness unto him, neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. So, you know, we can think about those verses, and of course we always apply them to the Word of God, the Bible, in our everyday life. But the fact of the matter is that the application here in our story, that we're, the verses that we're reading this evening in Genesis 41, they're just as applicable with Pharaoh's dream, with the butler's dream, with the baker's dream. So Joseph could have read Paul here, had Paul already written, and would have said, "Oh, I already knew that." And so these are verses that were very contemporary, would have been very contemporary had Joseph read them. And he was, "I agree heartily." So that's exactly, as Paul wrote these things, it wasn't like it was something brand new. Joseph would have definitely agreed with everything Paul wrote. So meanwhile, we know that God had saved the butlers, the chief butler's mention of Joseph, until this time where you have this, really this confluence of events. And all these things coming together, you have Pharaoh having a dream, and nobody can understand what it is, and as it turns out, the chief butler, he's waiting on Pharaoh, he's serving Pharaoh, and a lot. He was the one who was saved, didn't lose his head, obviously, because he's still alive. And so this whole dream thing jogs the chief butler's memory, and says, "Hey, oh, you know, it's just like a slap across the face or a bucket of water," and
yesterday.
Well, there you go. It just sort of jogs the memory. And he says, "Yeah, I could." Yeah, well, and it's sort of the same thing. And you know, he suddenly remembers, "Hey, there's this guy I know." And he then spake, verse 9, the chief butler unto Pharaoh. It never hurts to tell the boss, "I know someone that can help." Rather than standing around and risking the boss get mad at everybody, the butler already knows what happens when Pharaoh gets mad. And if you happen to be in the line of fire, it's not a good thing. So rather than letting that happen, say, "I know somebody that can help you out, chief." And so he does that very same thing. Then spake the chief butler unto Pharaoh, saying, "I do remember my faults this day." And I like the way he starts out. "I remember my faults." And Pharaoh was wroth with his servants, and put me in ward in the captain of the guard's house, both me and the chief baker. And we dreamed a dream in one night, I and he. We dreamed each man according to the interpretation of his dream. And there was with us a young man, a Hebrew. By the way, most Bibles, most of your contemporary New English, New Fad Bibles, will not tell Pharaoh that he was a Hebrew. Interestingly enough, I have no mention of the fact that he was Jewish. But, of course, the King James, being God's perfect word in the English language, does let Pharaoh know, in fact, that he is a Hebrew, which is important because that way Pharaoh understands that he is subject to the God, a different God. It's not Ra or the sun god or whatever. He's dealing with a different God. So at any rate, it's a Hebrew servant to the captain of the guard, and we told him, and he interpreted to us our dreams, to each man according to his dream he did interpret. And it came to pass, as he interpreted to us, so it was, me he restored unto mine office, and him he hanged. So the chief butler is saying, "I was a pretty lucky guy, and sorry about the baker." But meanwhile, it's interesting. If you remember back into the last chapter, when Joseph was interpreting the dream of this very man, the chief butler, he interpreted the dream and he made a request. Now, he didn't ask for payment try to get anything out of it before the interpretation of the dream. But after he interpreted the dream, he did make a request. And if you look at Genesis 40, verse 14 and 15, Joseph says to the butler, he says, "But think on me when it shall be well with thee, and show kindness, I pray, unto thee, unto me, and make mention of me unto Pharaoh, and bring me out of this house. For indeed, I was stolen away out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also have I done nothing that they should put me into the dungeon." Well, from reading those words, the assumption would be made, would it not, that Joseph is asking of this chief butler, "When you get back and are restored to your position, would you please mention to Pharaoh, I know this Hebrew back in the same jail where I was kept, and by the way, he's a great guy and he's able to interpret dreams, and he's put in jail for no reason at all. He's done nothing wrong, and he's there, and I want to put in a good word for him so that you might review his case and see if you can't get him out of there and let him go." Isn't that the way it sounds like to you? But in fact, what the chief butler has just done is in fact fulfilled what Joseph has asked of him, when you think about it. Because what Joseph asked was not that he, as soon as he gets back to his office, you know, as soon as he gets back, plead his case because on the grounds that, you know, he's been put into jail unjustly. What he says is, "But think on me when it shall be well with thee." There's every possibility that, when he was first restored back to office, it wasn't really well with him. He might have been on very shaky ground with Pharaoh for a long time. And that's exactly right. I mean, you know, he might have been on this, a probation type of situation, you know, because he was just let out of jail, and Pharaoh was very mad at him. And mad enough to throw him into jail, and he was mad enough at the baker to cut off his head. So it could have been the other way around. You know, he might have cut off the butler's head and kept the baker. You know, he was very likely on probation for quite a while. So it probably wasn't very well with him for quite a while. And so even though he had forgotten about Joseph, this whole incident came to jog his memory. Well, was it a godly incident? Absolutely, because these dreams were sent by God. So here is the kindness. Well, he did speak kindly about Joseph, didn't he? It says there was a young man, a Hebrew, and he interpreted our dreams and all that. And so he did show kindness. And he makes mention unto Pharaoh. And he does everything other than saying that he has done nothing. The only thing he didn't do was say that he was wrongly put in the jail. He didn't use that as a reason for Pharaoh to release him from the jail. Rather, he used the interpretation of dreams. So the request that Joseph made was fulfilled. It was just fulfilled in a way that we wouldn't have guessed it to be fulfilled. God used this man, he used the dream of Pharaoh and all those things in his own time. Once again, we often think that things should happen right away. And as we look at the request of Joseph and then what we deem to be the failure of the butler. Look at the last verse, verse 23 of chapter 40, which says, "Yet did not the chief butler remember Joseph, but forgot him." And so when you read that, you think, well, if he doesn't remember Joseph, but forgets him, It's a failure on the part of the chief butler, on the part of God, and yet another disappointment for Joseph in a whole string of disappointments and things gone awry. He hasn't done anything wrong, and yet his whole life has been nothing but a bunch of disappointments and bad circumstances. And here's just another one. And yet, as it turns out, had the chief butler gone and immediately said to Pharaoh, "Oh, by the way, there's this great guy back in the jail who doesn't deserve to be there," what's the chances that Pharaoh would have said, "Oh, well, let me just run right over and unlock the door so he can get out"? Because I'm sure that everybody in there says that they shouldn't be there. Never a prisoner has there ever been that said, "I absolutely deserve all the sentences that I've got." They're all innocent in prison, I can pretty much guarantee you. So God used each and every person in this whole scenario in his own time in order to bring about not only Joseph's release, but also to bring Joseph before Pharaoh, which is exactly what happens next. So the Pharaoh, verse 14, sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon, and he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came in unto Pharaoh. Notice that Joseph shaved himself. He did not want to offend Pharaoh. The Egyptians were shaved people, and the Hebrews were not. The Hebrews thought beard to be a thing of dignity, you know, something that was a mark of dignity type of deal. But the Egyptians thought it was a thing of offense. You look at 2 Samuel 10, verses 4 and 5. You see the incident where Hanan took David's servants and shaved off one half of their beards and cut off their garments in the middle, even to their buttocks, and sent them away, which I'm sure had to be a real picture. When they told it unto David, he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, "Tarry at Jericho until your beards be grown, and then return." So it was a shameful thing that their beards had been cut, and they had to wait until they grew back before they returned to Jerusalem. So the beard was a source of even pride for the Hebrew. Joseph, not wanting to offend the Pharaoh, the Egyptians, cut it off himself and shaved. So Joseph appears before, let me say this about that. Remember our Apostle Paul, and I don't have the address right now. Paul himself became as a Jew when he was speaking to the Jews, became as a Gentile when he was speaking to Gentiles. He became as those who he was speaking to so that he could all the more relate to the people that he was speaking to, so that the gospel would reach the ears of who he was speaking to. So, you know, if dressing, putting on a suit and tie offends the audience that you're going to speak to, then take off the suit and tie. If not having a suit and tie on is going to offend the audience that you're speaking to, put on a suit and tie. You know, certain people are just certain ways and do what you have to do so that they can hear what it is they need to hear. So at any rate, Joseph appears before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "I have dreamed a dream, and there is none that can interpret it. And I have heard say of thee that thou canst understand a dream to interpret it." So this would have been a really good time, of course, for most of us to have started a bargaining session, sort of like Congress is in right now. I've got something you need, and you have something I want. So Joseph could have bargained for his freedom, could have asked for money, could have done a whole lot of things, because he's dealing with the king, and he could have probably gotten whatever he wanted at that time, but he doesn't ask for anything in return. Rather, his answer is almost shocking. Rather than saying, "It's me that can interpret the dream," Joseph answers verse 16, Pharaoh, saying, "It is not in me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace." So he gives God all the credit for the interpretation of dreams. So Pharaoh's dreams are exactly as we've heard, but they're repeated again in the chapter. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, "In my dream, behold, I stood upon the bank of the river, and behold, there came up out of the river seven kine, fat-fleshed and well-favored, and they fed in a meadow. And behold, seven other kine came up after them, poor and very ill-favored and lean-fleshed, such as I never saw in all the land of Egypt for badness. And the lean and the ill-favored kine did eat up the first seven fat kine. And when they had eaten them up, it could not be known that they had eaten them, but they were still ill-favored as at the beginning. So I awoke, and I saw in my dream, and behold, seven ears came up in one stalk, full and good. And behold, seven ears withered and blasted with the east wind sprung up after them. And the thin ears devoured the seven good ears, and I told this unto the magicians, but there was not one that could declare it unto me." Well, the dreams are actually one dream of instruction, and that from God Almighty. So Joseph says unto Pharaoh, the dream of Pharaoh is one. God has showed Pharaoh what he is about to do. So this puts Pharaoh in subjection to God. You need to realize that Pharaohs were at this time worshipped as gods. So this puts Pharaoh in a rather unique place, because he then becomes subjected to God rather than being worshipped as God. So the dream of Pharaoh is one, and God has showed Pharaoh what he is about to do. So God's telling you what you're going to do, Pharaoh, is the answer. The seven good kine are 7 years, and the seven good ears are 7 years. The dream is one. So they're not separate dreams, but it's all about the same 7 years. And the seven thin and ill-flavored favored kine that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty ears blasted with the east wind should be 7 years of famine. This is the thing which I have spoken unto Pharaoh, what God is about to do, he showeth unto Pharaoh. Behold, there come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, and there shall arise after them 7 years of famine, and all the plenty shall be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and all the famine shall consume the land, and the plenty shall not be known in the land by reason of that famine following, for it shall be very grievous. So even though the 7 years of plenty will be extremely plenteous, they'll have overflowing amounts of harvest, the famine will be such that the will be so bad that the harvest will be so poor, those first 7 years will have been forgotten, almost unimaginable in scope. So God then has doubled the dream. If you remember, there was first the one dream, and then Pharaoh fell back asleep and dreamed the second dream. There's a principle in the Bible, And of course, you'll recognize the principle. In Genesis 41, verse 32, it's about establishing by more than one witness. Establishing a witness by using more than one witness. And in verse 32, Joseph tells Pharaoh, "For that dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice." It is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Well, if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 19, let me turn there for a moment. Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15. This is the first instance of this establishment. It shows up in Deuteronomy, it shows up in Matthew, and then it shows up in Paul's writings, I believe in 2 Corinthians. So this principle of establishment runs throughout the Bible. And Moses says in Deuteronomy 19:15, "One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin in any sin that he sinneth. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established." So if something's going to be established as a fact, it takes more than one witness to establish something. In other words, it takes the witness of two or three people to establish something as being factual. So, when we had the dreams of Pharaoh, remember the first time, the first dream of Pharaoh, excuse me, I have to have a drink here. The first dream of Pharaoh was the seven, concerning the seven cows. He had the fat cows come up out of the river, then the lean cows came up and ate the seven fat cows. Then he awoke and went back to sleep. Then you had the seven fat ears of corn, and they followed by the seven thin ears of corn, which ate the seven fat ears of corn. And he awoke again. So it was two dreams, but it was all the same meaning. But God doubled the dream. It was two dreams, which is actually one. So there was two witnesses. God gave two witnesses in establishing the two periods. The first period being the 7 years of famine, and then the 7 years of 7 years of sorry, 7 years of bounty, the 7 years of famine. That was the meaning of the first dream with the cows. Then the 7 years of bounty, and this is followed by the 7 years of famine. That was the meaning of the first of the 7 years of corn. God established that as immutable fact by giving Pharaoh the dream twice. So God being his own witness, what higher witness could you possibly have than God? God being his own witness established the two periods that it would certainly come to pass. In other words, there was no nobody could step in and pray away the coming of the famine. Men have changed God's mind in at times in history, there's instances of, if my people will do this, then disaster won't come. This was one of those where it's certainly going to happen. This has been set in stone because it's been established. So, according to that establishment principle, that's exactly what was going to happen. 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1 is where Paul uses that same principle. He says, "This is the third time I am coming to you. In the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established." So that's the third time in the Bible that principle is used. The other one being in the book of Matthew, and I don't have the address. But again, that principle runs throughout the Bible, and God Himself can establish whatever He wants by using Himself as a witness. So, knowing then that the famine is definitely coming, and that preceded by 7 years of bounty, then there's instruction given by God on how to handle the situation. Yes, Mike?
I got one question. Maybe it's off the wall, but listen to it.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Maybe it'll come to me.
It
just jumped out of my mind
that quick. Okay, that's all right. Things jump out of my mind all the time. If it jumps back in, just let me know. Okay. So God has His instruction for laying up the provision, and under the oversight of a wise man. Obviously, this is a nationwide type of crisis, and you need someone to oversee what's going to go on for 7 years in order to prepare for the seven lean years. And here in verse 33, Joseph says, "Now therefore let Pharaoh look out for a man discreet and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land, and take up the fifth part of the land of Egypt in the seven plenteous years." So 20% of everything that's produced is to go toward the storage and for the 7 years of famine. And let them gather all the food of those good years that come, and lay up corn under the hand of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities, and that food shall be for store to the land against the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land perish not through the famine. When you think about what's going on here, and you think about the history of Egypt and all that God eventually does to Egypt, the Israelites are in bondage in Egypt, and then how God turns his hand against Egypt when Israel leaves the country and destroys the army and takes all the wealth out of Egypt and just the numerous things and how Egypt really becomes synonymous with evil throughout much of the Bible and even before this time, when Abraham sort of made a right turn and went down into Egypt during the time of famine. It's always been a place that symbolized where you don't want to be. And even most mentions of Egypt in the Bible always symbolize the place that is going back to the world or away from God. It's just symbolically an evil, fleshly, lustful type of place. But here you see the hand of God making provision for His people through the agency of the country of Egypt. It's really quite remarkable.
I just said to you that thing.
Yeah.
Back then, he made people witnesses. Those people had to be witnesses for him, from John's baptism to his resurrection. All those people, mm-hmm. those were people that were witnesses for him. But today, we're witnesses by faith in this book. And we're using his words as a witness.
Right.
Yeah. You know, quoting these verses and telling people they're sinners and that they need to know what the gospel is and get the gift and all that. Is that two witnesses? Just saying, you know, the fact that I'm using these words, or anybody out preaching the gospel or something, you know, seeing that we can't go back and be witnesses because we weren't back there from John's baptism.
Oh, I understand what you're saying.
To his resurrection. And I'm just wondering if that's comparable or not. Yeah.
Well, you know, in its...
He gave us the ministry of reconciliation, you know.
That's true. You know, in its context, the Corinthians, as Paul says, they were seeking proof of Christ speaking in him.
Mm-hmm.
And
some believe and some don't. You know what I mean? When I tell them the gospel, some believe it and some people just won't touch it.
That's right. And Paul's answer to them in a lot of ways was, you know, I know who I am. And in verse 5 he says, examine yourselves whether you be in the faith. Prove your own selves. Know ye not your own selves how that Jesus Christ is in you, except you be reprobates.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you establish something in the mouth of two or three witnesses today, and, you know, oftentimes, you know, you might run into someone who says, well, I don't even believe in God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is God? You know, they might look at you and say, well, you're a Christian. What has God ever done for you? How do you know that God's alive and that there is a God? Well, that would be the time for the establishment of two or three witnesses. Because, you know, how do I know that God is alive? You know, Romans chapter 8 says we, you know, our spirit beareth witness with the Spirit of God that, and so that's how you know. Well, do I know that God's Spirit lives within me? Absolutely.
You believe the words, and the words effectually work in you, right?
Well, am I the same person that I was before when I was unsaved? Absolutely not. Does the Spirit of God work effectually in me? Absolutely. You know, there's all kinds of ways that I things that I can say to an unbeliever, someone who doesn't believe in God, and out of the mouth of two or three witnesses, that becomes a fact. I mean, when you have two or three people saying the same thing, then that becomes an established fact.
So if three people were out, would that be better than probably than one person being out there?
Something, when you run into that situation, it does. Yeah. It does. I mean, it's not that one person can't be effective, but in certain situations, more than one person can be effective. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you're out giving out the gospel, one person can be just as effective as two. But in certain situations, there's going to be where somebody just doesn't, you know, where you have to establish a fact that is a faith-based type of fact.
People, creation demands a creator.
and they might not see it that way. They might say, well, creation just demanded a big bang. That's right. Yeah. So, you know. So that's my answer for you there, you know, in the establishment of things that people just cannot understand. That if you have two or three witnesses saying the same thing
at the same time, or going to be at different times, where they might have to hear it from three different people the same thing.
Better at the same time, really.
Mm-hmm.
But not necessarily at the same time. It doesn't have to be, but you know, they might feel like intimidating. You're ganging up on them, I suppose, if it's all at the same time. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, last thing they want to do is come in and see two people arguing about something and say, these people can't agree.
Yeah,
exactly. You know what I mean? What would they
do here? Exactly right. Exactly right. So in any we're back to around verse 33. So in any enterprise, especially any nationwide enterprise, you need administrators and people to organize the whole endeavor. And even though Joseph did not suggest himself for any type of position, Pharaoh saw the benefit of having Joseph because of his what he saw was really divine endowment. He understood the godly influence that was in Joseph's life and the enablement that God was given to him. So in verse 37 we read, and the thing was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. So this whole plan to administer the storing of food was agreeable to Pharaoh and all the servants. And Pharaoh said unto his servants, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom the Spirit of God is? I find that quite remarkable, the statement made by Pharaoh. So Pharaoh is acknowledging the Spirit of God and God and the existence of God. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, for as much as God has showed thee all this, there is none so discreet and wise as thou art. So the position is given to Joseph. And when you read the job description here, which is really what it comes down to, the job description, Joseph is made, in effect, Pharaoh. There's really not a whole lot of other way to describe it. He is made ruler of Egypt. You know, I sat and thought about what I could compare it to, and the closest I could come would be, for instance, Great Britain. How they have a prime minister and then a monarch, which is, what do they have right now? Queen, I guess. So they have a prime minister and a queen. Who really rules rules the government? It's the prime minister. The queen is like a figurehead, sits on the throne, but she doesn't really do anything in the day-to-day government. She, you know, of course, she benefits. She sits on the throne. She goes, there's a lot of money. Of course, she toodles all over the world, and I'm sure the perks are really good, but as far as the administering of the government goes, she doesn't do anything. Well, that would be pretty much the situation with this, with what's set up here. Joseph is really the one running the country, and the Pharaoh is sort of like Queen Elizabeth, I guess, yeah, Queen Elizabeth, but he says, sitting on the throne, reaping the benefits, the perks are real good, but not a whole lot to do, for the most part. Just living out your dotage in a pretty good comfort, you know. Pool in the backyard and a Rolls Royce out front. You know, who could ask for more? So, starting in verse 40, Pharaoh says, thou shalt be over my house, and according unto thy word shall all my people be ruled. So anything you say goes, is what he says. Only in the throne will I be greater than thou. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, see, I have set thee over all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it upon Joseph's hand. So there, you know, it doesn't. You think about that. He took off the ring of the signet of his power and put it on Joseph's hand. And Joseph took off. And arrayed him in vestures of fine linen, and put a gold chain about his neck, And I'm getting to the verse where I'm going to have all kinds of trouble here pretty soon. And he made him to ride in the second chariot, which he had, which was also made by Rolls Royce. And they cried before him, bowed the knee, and he made him ruler over all the land of Egypt. So people would bow down before his chariot, just same as they did Pharaoh's. And Pharaoh said unto Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without thee shall no man lift up his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. So, and Joseph was the man. I mean, Pharaoh was sat on the throne, but Joseph was the man. That's pretty good for a low Hebrew boy. Now, here's the verse where I'm going to have all kinds of trouble. Joseph is given not only an Egyptian name, but an Egyptian wife. And if you can name this name, I'll give you $5. The Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paneah, I believe is what it is. I only say that once. And he gave him to wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharpha, or I think that's what it is, priest of On. It's a good thing I wasn't born an Egyptian. I would have never said anything. And Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. Now, before we end up this evening, I just wanted to mention this. Because Joseph is going to have children by this Asenath, who is an Egyptian young lady. There has been, over the course of years, objections, as if it makes any difference now, objections to the fact that Joseph had an Egyptian wife. Well, first of all, I doubt that Joseph is going to get a divorce at this late date. We're probably stuck with the fact that he had married an Egyptian. But more importantly, when you think about it, where was he really going to go to get a wife? You think about his daddy, Jacob. Well, his dad, Jacob, went to Laban's house to get a wife. Well, he's not going to go to Laban's. He's not going to go anywhere near his brothers. His brothers are the ones who sold him to Egypt. Where exactly is he going to go to get a Hebrew girl? Which bar is he going to hang out at? So, an Egyptian's probably as good as it gets. Besides that, he can't go to the Canaanites because, according to Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 17 and 18, if you read that, marriage to the Canaanites was forbidden. If you remember the instructions to Isaac and the instruction to Jacob, the Canaanites were off limits. I'll read the verses, but thou shalt, as the Israelites were to go into the land of Canaan, God gave instructions, thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord the God, thy God hath commanded thee, that they teach you not to do after their abominations, which they have done unto their gods, should ye sin against the Lord your God. So in other words, all those were off limits as far as taking a wife. And God had expressly forbid marrying into those, even at the time that Jacob and Isaac were around, so Joseph knew that. Meanwhile, Egyptians were not off limits, and later on it was written into the law that other nationalities were not off limits. For instance, in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 10, just a few verses down the road from what I just read you about the Canaanites, when thou goest forth to war against thine enemies, and the Lord thy God hath delivered them into thine hands, and thou hast taken them captive, and seest among the captives a beautiful woman, and hast a desire unto her, that thou shouldest have her to thy wife. Then thou shalt bring her home to thy house, and shall shave her head, and pair her nails. And if she still looks good after you've done all that, and she shall put that raiment of her captivity from off her, and shall remain in thine house and bewail her father and mother a full month. And after that, thou shalt go in unto her and be her husband, and she shall be thy wife. So, anything other than the ites, the Canaanites, Jebusites, Hittites, Perizzites, and Pezzorites, and Amorites, and Jebusites, whatever the ites were all fine and dandy as long as you followed those rules. So, there's no reason in the world why an Egyptian shouldn't be the wife of Joseph. And so there you have it. I think he did a fine choice in marrying that Egyptian, fine Egyptian young lady.